Do have a fellow Zoom people. Thanks, Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
I
And you know what? I normally do this kind of privately aside, but I do it in front of you guys and have you listen in. I say a set-aside prayer before I do most leads and meetings. It reads as follows: Lord, today help me set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, and everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery. For a new experience of myself, a new experience of my fellows, and my own recovery. And I'm a Roman Catholic, and this is our season of Lent. And I just heard a prayer that goes hand in hand with that. It's real simple. It's empty me, fill me, use me. That's about as most succinct set-aside prayers I've heard. So I'm going to start leaning on that too. My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's October 23rd, 2011. I have a sponsor, my third one actually. He knows he's my sponsor. We meet regularly. And I have the pleasure of working with a number of men in the program. And that'll be a part of my remarks down the road. My home group is the Great Fact Group, which meets at Church of Our Savior off Rail Road every Saturday morning at 9. Come visit us. We do a wonderful step meeting every week. You're hearing me tonight because I also, on occasion, attend the Common Solution in that same facility. And it was a tradition meeting. And that particular night was led by a guy named Billy. And he really brought it and excited me to no end because I'm a rare traditions nut, a savant. And I was asked to share right after Billy. My unbridled enthusiasm caught Billy's attention. And he asked me to speak tonight. So you have Billy to thank or blame for what's about to follow here. Let's see. So I told you my home group and all that sort of stuff. Got the housekeeping stuff out of the way. Not my first rodeo. Told the story a bunch. I don't work off of notes. It's right up here. And it's not that it's a story that stayed the same. Not that it's changed. It's just evolved. I have more to add to it. I'm not as big into the drunkalogs these days. And I was when I first came in because that's all I knew. And as time comes on, has gone on, it interests me less. When I tell my story in a meeting like tonight, I got to share some of that to let you know that I earned my seat in here. And maybe you can identify with some of the things I share. I was filled with a little bit of inadequacy when I was first asked to speak. Like, gee, do I have a compelling enough tale that's going to keep people riveted on the edge of their seats? I didn't think I did. It was very early in my recovery, the first time I was asked to speak. And again, I just let it flow. And I think by the time I got to my junior high years, the chair said, we have a nice way of closing. So I've learned to trim it down a little bit, and you won't hear the unabridged version. Just stick with the highlights. I'm the middle of three boys, born in Atlanta, Georgia. That's where we spent the diaper years. But from late 60s, we moved up to the People's Republic of Northern Virginia. It was McLean, where I grew up and spent the K through 12 years. And I don't have a Charles Dickens story to share with you of any troubled upbringing. Didn't grow up in an alcoholic household. Wonderful, loving parents, charmed life and upbringing. But there is alcoholism in the family tree. If you looked at our tree, both sides were pretty withered. My dad's an only child, but his family ravaged with alcoholism and tuberculosis. He was over on the West Coast. He's one of those guys who made the geographic change to get away from it and start anew, a cycle breaker, if you will. And he wanted to give his sons a better life than what he had. My mom's the youngest of four, and all three older siblings had this disease. And both my mom and my dad, their fathers were both among our ranks without the recovery, especially my dad's father. He died of cirrhosis. But my folks kept that close to their chest. They didn't really share a lot of that until it came time to shed some light that maybe you should know this about our family tree, Mike, now that you're in the throes of it. That's down the road. So in those formative years, I kept my nose pretty clean and did okay in school. I had fun with friends, but when it came to that high school time where guys were having keg parties on the weekends and the parents were away, I sort of looked down my nose at that, going, oh, that's underage drinking, guys. Those are real goody two shoes. So where did it all begin? I got a late start relative to a lot of my peers. It was after graduation. And the rite of passage at our school, as is with many, is Beach Week. You know, the seniors all go to Beach Week. And that's where I thought, you know, I really did well in high school. I got a lot of hardware and plaques and just for my involvement and being really active in activities. My grades were okay, but I showed an awful lot of promise. And I thought it was time to reward myself and see what this experience was, this alcohol thing. And it was Beach Week that I put on my first drunk, and it was a good one. It was rum and cokes, very pale. And I paid the price dearly the next day, but the reaction I had, oh, that was fun. It really was. I'm already extroverted as it is. I'm not like one of those wallflowers that comes to life after my first drink. I just become super obnoxious. So I'm even super extra extroverted. You know, lampshade goes on the head, and I'm forever the jester. So I love the brand of honesty and courage it gave me, what they call it, liquid courage. So that happened. And I was off to college. And I didn't go from that experience in the to living under a bridge. My spiral in the my 25-year journey of alcoholism would be not as rapid as some of my peers. I know I have folks my age that came in their teens and they're still here. And to use the metaphor of skiing, they probably came right down a triple diamond slope end over end into the lodge. Whereas I took back that bunny slope, you know, the slow spiral down the mountain, 25-year route, and then tumbling toward the end. That would be more my journey. So I didn't go to living under a bridge, but you know, one thing was clear from the first time I drank to get drunk. I really had a responsible cutoff, and those episodes of drinking were pretty spread out. Managed to keep up with my studies, but I look back now, I can compare the yearbooks of high school to college. In high school, I was on every page in every club involved, and I was kind of becoming a little more anonymous, if you will, in college. I prided myself that I wasn't involved in anything. I laid low. I didn't appear in any yearbooks. And I don't know, where did that happen? And maybe it went hand in hand with the drinking. I don't know. But I wouldn't say consequences were really creeping up for me. I was pretty much on pace with a lot of my peers. We played hard. We worked hard. We played hard. And into my early 20s, when we left college and went to the work world, same thing. And I had an awful lot of fun. But again, ditching consequences, I could always look over my shoulder and say, well, I'm not as bad as old drunk Joe over there. And certainly there were people on a more accelerated path to a bottom. But I stayed that course. So to skip forward, the things that tend to slow up in 20s are things like marriage, you know, and having kids. And some of my friends were doing that, but somehow I just wanted the party to keep going. Even after I got married, you know, I still didn't understand why people were hey, where's the booze, you know? So I did get married. I met a gal from England on a cruise, and we had a pretty quick courtship before we got married. And a year later, we had a kid. We had some good times at the beginning, but alcohol was not good to us. Now, I'm not going to brand my wife at the time as having our problem, but I don't think alcohol agreed with her or with us, because when we were both inebriated, you know, there were volatile, we fought, and wasn't pretty. It got us in front of a marriage counselor. And this is really where the first flag came up in my realization that maybe there's a problem. And it wasn't a realization I had. We had problems, and it didn't take long for my wife to be homesick and want to go back to England, and she threatened. No, I didn't want that. I'll do anything to save the marriage, and we have a son, and go around in a Catholic family. You know, last I never wanted to do drugs, smoke, or get a divorce. Well, only two of those things I could were just involving me. I have a partner in the marriage, and that person has to be on board with my mission statement. And she wasn't. She was ready to leave it all behind and go home. So there was a lot of threatening to leave. I said, no, let's save this. And she said, well, we got to see a marriage counselor. And she put it to me to find one. Opened up the Yellow Pages, and I went to the first number. Called the lady. She says, how'd you get this number? I said, well, it's in the Yellow Pages. You're the first entry. Oh, well, I'm trying to get out of the business. Well, okay, I'll see you on Thursday. And it was an older woman who just moved down from New York, and she was just kind of at the tail end of her career as a marriage counselor. But there was some backstory to her, and I never quite figured it out. And it wasn't for her place to have to share it with us. But we went to this home. She met with us, and then she met with us individually. First, my wife, and then me. When it came my time to sit down, first thing she said to me was, Mike, I hear you have a drinking problem. Oh, really? Where did you hear that? I knew I was outed. And her next line was, you have to stop. That was it. No pulling out pamphlets from the nearest AA meeting or brochures about alcoholism. None of that. She says, just, you got to stop. I said, okay. And then she handed me this one sheet Xerox thing, and it was on Jelinek's disease. Don't know if any of you have heard of that. It's kind of a fancy word for alcoholism. There's a guy named Jelinek, earlier part of the last century, who about the time of Silk Worth was a leading authority in the area of alcoholism studies. And he came up with Jelinek's disease, which is fancy speak for alcoholism. He had his own name for that. And this woman in this article was making a case that I have Jelinek's disease. And it was the first time that I ever considered, as she put it, that why alcoholism doesn't garner as much sympathy as other sicknesses and illnesses, the way a lot of other mental health issues don't, because you see someone in a wheelchair, like you have sympathy, but if someone has a mental problem, it's like, get over it. And that's how alcoholism is treated. But what she put forth in this article was that alcoholism was a physiological disease. I always thought alcohol, maybe if you drink enough, you get addicted, but no, it's something that we're born with. It's this gene inside of us that gives us this physical allergy that drives the allergy, the reaction, and the compulsion. Never quite considered that. So what did I do with this information? And she said, you got to stop. I stopped. I stopped for 2 whole years. Now you think the proper AA thing to say to you is it was hell. I did it without AA. It was a white knuckle experience. It wasn't. I was 10 years into my drinking and I wanted to save the marriage. So put the plug in the jug. Didn't make a declaration to anybody about quitting drinking. Those who noticed, like coworkers and so forth, I would just say, yeah, I'm just backing off for a while. I backed off for 2 whole years. And I got to admit, I was enjoying the benefits, the weight loss, the new spring in my step, the energy getting up at a decent hour, being present and accounted for the family. I liked all that. It was working for me. So what happened? I didn't have any AA in my life. I didn't have any spiritual toolkit. I just stopped drinking. And it was, I guess they say it's cunning and baffling, but it's also patient. Because it was 2 years later, we just bought a new home in a cul-de-sac with some lovely neighbors. We just built a deck in our backyard. And imagine these beautiful days we're having. It was like that kind of spring day, a little plush outside. We decided to throw a party for the neighbors and their families. And so it was upon me to be a good host, go out and get the beverages, big plastic tub with ice and sodas and waters and some adult beverages because I'm a good host. And you know something? There were some new beers in the market that looked kind of delicious. That had the thirst kind of kicked in. Oh, you say you put a lemon wedge in there and not a lime. Oh, this is intriguing. Hefeweizen, you say. And I was curious. And I wasn't secretive about it. I went to my wife at the time and I said, you know, I haven't had a drink for 2 years, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And you know what she said? She said, I don't think you are either. I'm proud of you. And so down the hatch went, and it started right back up again. And I was drinking the way I did before. And she started getting homesick again. Took a solo trip back to England and left my son and I, then age five, back at home. We picked her up at the airport. She was really quiet the whole ride home. We got home, she sent our son to his room and immediately told me she's ready to leave. She was going to leave. Wasn't anything to debate at this point in time. As many arguments as we had, she was leaving. She wanted to bring James, our son. And it was the toughest decision I've ever had to wrestle with there, but most of the deciding was already done. Later, she would disclose that her mother, who wanted her back, had introduced her to someone else. So off they went about 2 months after that for good. And I had a solution. Alcohol. Lots of it. Lots of it. I became the if you had my life, you drink too. All those problems I didn't have growing up were starting to kick in now. And I was having that sort of life. And boy, did I drive the self-pity thing. And I had lots of friends that sympathized for me, but bought me drinks that said, oh boy, that sucks, Mike. And anyone I would meet, you know, I grew to really not like having the conversation of my story. And so, what's up with you? Well, I got a son who's in England. Oh, that must suck. Yeah. I started hating hearing that after a while. I just became mum about my bio. But you know what? Every time I heard that, it validated my misery. I don't have a drinking problem. I have a life that I drink at. And I'd worked that for about 12 years. I have problems that last me that long. And in that time, I started getting the frothy appeals that we hear about. I know what they sound like, just that concern. Mike, you know, we're concerned about you. We think you're not taking care of yourself. You're self-destructive. And I know how to I deflect those frothy appeals that they say seldom suffice. You're absolutely right, Dr. Silkworth. I do. Thanks for your concern. I think I got this, but I appreciate you looking out for me. But now I knew who to avoid and who to hide my drinking from after that. After about 5 years from that separation, I met yet another woman. And I was self-conscious about my situation. I'd sold the house, moved back in with my parents. You know, I'm in my 30s and I'm back at home to save up money to visit my son and all that, and not really thinking I have the goods to meet someone else. So I really wasn't out in the market trying to meet the next Mrs. Mike. But I did eventually meet a woman, and she was not judgmental of that. It was the days of wine and roses, and she was seemed like she was drinking as much as I was, and this is perfect. And we rushed to the altar almost as quickly as I did with the first wife. But you know, it didn't take long for that bridal veil to drop to realize that she didn't drink like me. And the sin disease is progressive because the way I lied to the first wife was about how much I drank. I'd come home smelling like a distillery. And how many drinks did we have, right? Two beers, right? Two. That's the magic number. Granted, the beer, the drinks are this big, but that's what I would say. Now at this stage, I was starting to hide the empties, hide the bottles, hide the drinks. And this is just a little tip. If you decide to go out and relapse, and which I encourage you not to, I wasn't very clever with my hiding of my bottles. I thought I was. But I heard someone share in a meeting, it was a woman. She said she had hid her bottles in the vacuum bag. I'm telling you, there's no husband in America that will look in a vacuum bag. That's genius. Don't go out though. It's not endorsing any relapse, but I just, wow. Why didn't I think of that? So, yeah, the hiding, that's where I was. That was a very short-lived marriage. It was experimental at best. And that was all up in Northern Virginia. By this time, and it wasn't a matter of if, but when, and it just ended badly. And my brother lived down here in Charlottesville, and he had a big house. A roommate just moved out, and the time seemed right. I loved my visits down here. It was just, yeah, I went to JMU over the mountains, and there's Nova, which is Northern Virginia, and then there's Rova, which is the rest of Virginia. And I realize I'm more of a Rova person at heart. I love the mountains. I'd love to drive up here today, you know, come to the Blue Ridge Turnpike from my home down the road. I mean, I've been here ever since that move, which was 2008. And it was a great situation. My older brother, 13 months older than me, he had his life. He did his thing. He wasn't going to be a chaperone at all. Me? Wow. It's just me. No chaperone. No one looking after me anymore. Just me and the bottle. Going to have some fun. Going to go find some new watering holes. And I did. They all knew me by name very quickly. And they knew my drink. As long as I don't drink and drive, right? I drank and drove all the time, you know, with the same game plan every night, getting home like this. And I had a lost weekend down here that lasted about 3 years, a 3 year lost weekend. And all that promise I showed you back in high school, and this guy's going to do something with his life. And I was never going to get divorced. I was becoming that person that to me was a stereotype, the alcoholic, the philanderer, the jerk, that I was becoming that guy. I was involved in extramarital activity, other homes, wrecking homes. I was a 24/7 pleasure seeking missile, get out of my way, complete bondage of self. And I was a consummate people pleaser. And if you know what that means, it doesn't have anything to do with my concern for your well-being. It's that you think the most of me, no matter what I do, even though I desecrate the earth during the evening, I want you to like me the next morning. That's a torturous existence, because there's people you don't win back when you behave the way I did. And I think there's still a price in my head out there. But that's what amends are for, right? So that's the kind of life I was leading, and the drinking was spiraling way out of control. It got to the point I was thinking, when was the last day I had where I wasn't inebriated? Drinking to the point of inebriation, I couldn't remember. Even through a sick day, if I had a cold or the flu, I'd still kind of find my way to a beverage at the end. It wouldn't take much. I'd just go, you know, I'm going to take a break today. And they talk about triggers. Well, for me, I'd just see a commercial and some couple enjoying a bottle of wine on a deck of a cruise ship, and it's a travel agent ad. Out comes the corkscrew. Well, tomorrow, I'll rent back. So, and I just had this Groundhog Day existence of, if you break a day into 8 hours, I had 8 hours of recovering with a hangover, 8 hours of creating one, and then 8 hours of passing out, and then just starting the cycle over again. And where those hours fall is kind of messed up with what normal people, how normal people live, when like getting up at the crack of noon, that kind of cycle. So that's the kind of life I was leading. It was just day after day like that, a groundhog day cycle. Now, this disease left untreated will take you to one of three places: hospitals, jails, or the morgue. I got to two of those three places. Spoiler alert, it wasn't the morgue, but it was the other two places, starting with the hospital. Because of not taking care of myself and drinking as much as I did, the body starts to bark back, like did with my grandfather with cirrhosis. And I found myself with a pulmonary embolism. And that is something that's you might hear about in international flights, like get up and move around and circulate your legs, lest clots form and come up and kill you. Well, that's what was happening to me because I was traveling in planes, trains, and automobiles, and sitting in whatever seat that was in the plane or the train or the back of someone's car, passed out from whatever I did the night before. So those legs weren't getting circulated. This pain started developing in my back calf, which I run, I jog, believe it or not, even during my drunken days. And I just thought it was like a muscle cramp, but there was no relief. And on this trip up to New York, I had that pain throughout, and it was static. There was no relief or stretching it out. And by the time I got home, a gal I was dating noticed me wincing when I, like a tick almost. And it was because of a pain in my chest. Well, that's what happens with a pulmonary embolism, like starts in the leg, moves up to the lungs, and it'll kill you, like an aneurysm or something. And I checked myself in the Martha Jeff, and they brought me 2 days there. They said, had I not checked in, I probably would have died. So I put down the bottle. No, I didn't. It wasn't enough of a warning shot for me to turn things around, but I realized, yeah, really should cut back on my drinking. So I made a point of ramping things down. And but I didn't quit. I wasn't ready to do that. And I was filled with the cockiness throughout all of this. Did I remember that time I quit for 2 years? I could do that again. I have this feather in my cap. I could do that anytime I wanted. But this is a progressive disease. I was 10 years into my drinking when I did that. This is 12 more years with a lot of drinking, and that was 12 years. I wasn't driving the bus anymore. There was no feather to pull out of my cap. That's why I couldn't quit completely. And I was doing okay with the ramping down and not drinking as much. But when you don't have a spiritual toolkit and life goes sideways, what do you have to reach for except a physical toolkit, which is a bottle opener and a corkscrew? And that's what I did on a weekend where it was a perfect storm of shinola, of the unexpected death of a friend, problems I was having with my relationship, and just general self-loathing, all colliding on a weekend where I kind of took a break from that resolve to ramp down my drinking and drown my sorrows. First night, friends wrestled keys out of my hands, but up till then, I was masterful at the Irish exit. Heaven forbid, I take a cab home and have to come back and spend all that money. I'd rather spend it all on a DUI, right? Well, the next night, I wasn't as fortunate. I was on a tear. I was really on a bender that weekend. It was a similar situation. I was at a party, and I proceeded on through town. And I wasn't really known for blackouts in my drinking. I think I had a number of brownouts. And on that night, I believe I did. Last drink I would ever have would be at the bar called Maya, downtown Charlottesville. I knew the bartender well. And there was a gentleman leaving, trying to hail down a cab. And I said, save your money, I'll take you home. And I did. Funny story, I never knew who that was until just a year ago. And this guy said, hey, how you been? And it was him, and what a reunion that was. But that's another story. Because I could never remember who it was I gave the ride home to. But it was somewhere in a corner of town that I must have pulled over for like a little nappy poo or something. And I was driving through town when there was not a soul on the road. I was going through where the Lewis and Clark statue used to be, right through the center of downtown. And I didn't realize I'd run a red light, but someone else did. It was the cop who pulled me over, who I almost T-boned in running over that red light. Up to that point, I'd been seeing these ads on TV and said they're trying to dissuade people from drunk driving. I don't know how effective those campaigns are, but I would watch those ads going, yeah, they should get those guys off the road. That was my attitude. Surely they weren't talking about me. But I was starting to come around to believe that not if that happens, but when that happens. I was kind of coming to grips with my powerlessness over this disease, even though I wasn't admitting at the time that I was probably headed toward that. I was convinced that there was a guardian angel that kept me away from DUIs up to that point in time, because God's got to protect his gesture, right? Well, that guardian angel took the night off. And on that way home, that cop pulled me over. And what those ads were saying is that when a drunk driver gets pulled over, it turns a laughing man into a baby. And they showed the man crying after he's been laughing all night long. I thought, I wonder if I'm going to bawl like a baby when I get pulled over. Not if, but when. That's what I was thinking. And when I got pulled over, that didn't happen. I didn't bawl. I'm not saying I'm macho or anything like that. It's just that I just look at those lights. I had a white light moment, but the lights were blue and red. And I said, the gig is up. This is the end of the line. And I ran out of fingers to point. I schmoozed my way out of a lot of pullover situations in the past, or I would happen upon the fortunate luck of a cop asking for my license and registration, and the radio goes off in his car and goes, I got to take this. Hey, you be careful, letting me go. That happened on more than one occasion. Again, making me believe that I was bulletproof from this, but not that night. The cop was laughing. He said, well, I was going to be taking the night off. I guess I got some paperwork to do. And he brought me in, and that got me my first experience of a DUI, and my only to date. Sorry, that was loud for you, Zoom people. Yeah, looks like they're all asleep anyway, but I don't blame them. So that got me my first night in jail, and my only one to date. And I had life flashing before my eyes. I never had an experience like that. Don't know if any of you have. And I did not see my life coming to this, and my life was going before my eyes. And I immediately went back to my hometown and the town paper, because I absorb what people think about me. Promising high school grad gets DUI. Big headline with my picture, my mugshot on there. And of course, that didn't happen. I would make crime times a couple times though. Yay. Not the hometown paper. And it was a disgraceful thing. And I was just discharged the next morning. I wish I could tell you it was my idea to get to my first AA meeting. No, it took a couple of HP moments to get me there. And I'll take the time to tell you how it manifested. The Albemarle County Jail is kind of the armpit of town, right down Ridge Road, on the other side of the interstate. And they just kind of dumped me off on the road. My car was impounded on a lot about 5 miles away. So I was making that Sunday morning walk of shame. And there weren't a lot of people I was eager to call, but the few friends, partying friends, I'd see if I could get a ride from them. They weren't picking up their phones that morning. I crossed over the interstate. A strange call came from a friend from Nashville, just out of the blue. And as I was talking with him, old beat up sedan pulls by, pulls over. It's a friend of mine, a guy named Tommy. If you saw him, he looks a little bit like the Unabomber, a little sketchy, but he happens to be a friend of a very lovely guy, lives south towards Scottsville by himself, really into the music scene, which I was too. He said, hey, Mike, you need a ride? He had a low, gruff voice. Said, absolutely. I jumped in. And in that 5 mile ride, I unloaded on Tommy what had happened. Boo-hoo. I was feeling pretty low at that point in time. We got to the wrecker yard right there at Freebridge, not far from Cosner Auto Body. And I said, hold me. He said, well, Mike, I'm going to wait here. Make sure you get your car okay. I said, okay. And I went in, and sure enough, they needed $50 cash. I didn't have any cash on me. Went out to the car, and Tommy reached in his pocket and gave me the 50 bucks. He said, Mike, I know you're good for it. You just call me, let me know you get home okay, all right? I said, absolutely, Tommy. I am good for it. I'm going to get back to you. Up to that point, and that short walk that I had, I was already calculating, because I'm a dishonest, lying SOB of an alcoholic, how I'm going to lie to everybody about this DUI incident, and how I'm going to suspiciously be on a tropical vacation when I'm really doing the jail time I need to for the DUI. I was figuring it all out and what I was going to tell everybody. But that moment of grace right then, slipping me the 50 bucks, was just like, who am I kidding? And how many breaks am I going to get where a cop drives away instead of writing me up? And this was a sign that I needed to come clean. So I got home, smiled and dialed, called mom and dad, called my little brother. And because my little brother and my dad were the two major frothy appeal guys who I kind of blew off before. independent. My little brother's a psychiatrist too. He's familiar with recovery and all that. My dad and my brother, independently, without conferring with one another, said to me, "Mike, don't waste any time. Get to an AA meeting." My folks were ecstatic to hear from me. My mom dropped the phone because and her rosary. I think she was glad. Really, they were delighted to hear me desperate and low, like some my skull had been cracked open enough to, for the ideas again. So that was a beautiful thing. Before I get on to the AA experience, after I got to my first meeting, I called Tommy, who gave me the ride. And Tommy's no longer with us. He passed a few years ago. When I called him that next the day after my first meeting, which was pretty much right after getting dispensed from jail, I said, "Tommy, why don't you know I got to my first AA meeting." He says, "No, it's funny, Mike. Gets me every time. I carry my father's 38-year medallion in my pocket." Sometimes God shows up and other times God shows off. And so I did get to that first meeting. A friend escorted me there. And I was having a conversation with a gentleman here about the real meetings. AA meetings don't look like they do on TV in the films. And I'm so delighted for the first meeting experience I had, because what I saw, again, I was still lower than low. I was still fuming from my hangover. I still had cigar on my breath and was just feeling that hangover funk. It didn't take much to look better than me, but that's what I saw on the faces of people at me. I have no idea what the topic was. I'm not a big fan of, "Oh, we got a newcomer. Let's talk about the first step." Not a fan of that. Just let a meeting be what a meeting is going to be. If there's someone new here, it's fresh off the bottom. They're not going to absorb a single word you say, but they know they're in the right place. And anything you say that meeting is not going to keep them from their second just because it's foreign to them. So I got news for you. The first step doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to someone who's brand new off the streets either. So to turn an AA meeting to 8-101, it's condescending and it doesn't benefit anyone. It just turns into a lot of crosstalk. And that's just, and again, I don't speak for AA, but that's just how what I appreciate. Because I can't tell you what the topic was my first meeting, but I saw the joy of living in people's faces that immediately wanted what they had. So it didn't keep me from my second meeting. I hit AA, I hit it hard. And I listened to pretty much 90% of what you had to say. 90 meetings in 90 days. Yep, can do that. Yeah, hit the meetings hard. And meetings. That part I liked. This get a sponsor, work the steps thing. I was, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I can sponsor myself. Whenever I hear people come in and say that, I laugh because I thought that too. It's not that inane a thought, but when you're kind of conceited like me and you go, "Well, you might quit drinking 2 years ago. I'm kind of special." I'm not. And I didn't come to the revelation to get a sponsor. There's a gentleman who saved my life because he recognized by my naivete in the meeting that I was without a sponsor. He called me on it after the meeting, not during the meeting, because I said something just sounded newcomery. And he said, "See me after the meeting." First thing he says, "You don't have a sponsor, do you?" "No." Said, "Meet me Saturday. Bring your big book, your pen, and a highlighter. We're going to go through the steps." Didn't ask. He told me. Now, I could have said no. He didn't have a gun in my head. But think about that. Again, I don't speak for AA. We've really kind of soft-pedaled what it means to sponsor people in this program. When we say to them, "Look for someone who has what you want," he wasn't waiting to be asked. He availed himself to me. I wouldn't have approached him. He approached me, and it saved me from that disappearing act that could have taken me right back out in AA after getting comfortable in the seats and then identifying out all that burnout without recovery. But he got me busy, and I'm just grateful for that. And I bring that up because I've made a point to follow his example. When I get, I don't, I people wrote down phone numbers in my first book, and I used a couple of them, but I can't tell you how many times I've written a phone number down in a pamphlet or a big book, but I can count on my fist how many times I've been called. Who's going to call you? I mean, that's a that phone. It doesn't weigh 800 pounds. It weighs a gazillion tons. And then I get a call. So I make a point of getting their number at the end in a gentle way. So let's exchange numbers so I can follow up with them at the end of the day. Say, "Great to meet you. You want to meet for coffee or whatever." To kind of move that along. In my current home group, I'm actually a sponsor liaison, and it's helping guys match up with sponsors. Not not just leaving it to the newcomers to find someone that has what they want. Because I don't know if that's really the best course of action. If I want to find someone that has what I want someone that doesn't isn't going to bother me. No, if find someone that has what they want, I think it's the best course of action. So that's what happened there. Now, move forward. Another area where I dropped the ball was in my first year and a half when they when I get to that 12th step, and this is what my sponsor did with me. He dog-eared the working with others chapter. He was really old school. He handed me the books and said, now go work with someone else. Okay. We didn't keep meeting with each other and he wasn't checking up on me. So I took full advantage of that. Didn't work with anyone. I just kept going back to meetings. Man, taking this wonderful gift that you guys have given me. And by the way, I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm not recovering. I don't debate that with anybody. You can say recovering if you want. I'm recovered. You guys have taken my thirst away. But I'm not going to say to my newcomer friends, welcome to a life of white knuckling. No, that's not my life today. You guys took my thirst and my compulsion away. I want to celebrate that. I want to proclaim that that's happened for me, and it can happen for anyone if they work the steps. But I was working an 11-step program by not turning around and helping someone else out. Does AA suffer? Not as much as I did. Because when I come to the meetings and it's just me and my recovery, and I'm not turning around and helping someone else out, and they say, if you don't give it away, you can't keep it. To keep it, you got to give it away. What that looks like is I show up at meetings and I'm starting to take your inventories. And I'm starting to notice who took the last brownie. And I'm starting to notice that person that repeated the share from last time. I'm noticing the person that came in late and left early. I'm noticing the person that just didn't share on topic or double dipped. And I'm burning out from the AA experience. And that's not good. That's not a good place to be. And that's where I was headed. I was kind of burning out. I didn't like that because I loved AA otherwise. But inside of me, what's wrong? Because I wasn't giving a gift away. That would eventually happen when a fellow approached me in a meeting. Again, I didn't seek it. Someone approached me and he recognized me from outside the rooms. And I said, so have you come to this meeting before? He says, no, well, actually, this is my first meeting. Oh, oh, thanks God, I got it. He was dropping a first sponsee in my lap and we got to work. And wouldn't you know it? 1 week turned into a month. We get into the steps. He had problems at home, and he and his wife are doing great. They get pregnant. His job's coming back. We get to 6 months. We get to 8 months, 9 months. They have a little boy. They name him after me. And then they get to that 1 year medallion, and I've never hugged a man harder in my whole life. And they've been inviting me over every Thanksgiving since. None of that happened. He left after the fourth step. There was no baby. There was no child named after me. Sorry to string you along like that. But that was the envision I had for myself as a sponsor. I'm going to be a big hero. They're going to erect a statue in my honor, and I'm going to save lives. Don't you know? He walked out on me. The next sponsee no showed for the second meeting. The third sponsee, same thing. Fourth sponsee fired me. There's a lot of swinging and missing. And I needed that humility to realize that sponsoring is not about me being a hero. That's God's work. I just get to be the Sherpa that walks them to the step. They're a freshman. I'm a sophomore. They don't know how to get from the gymnasium to the library. I do. Follow me. And if they relapse, I don't take blame for that. And if they get recovery, I don't take credit. But it keeps me sober. Let me tell you something. To keep it, you got to give it away. Nuh-uh. To get it, you got to give it away. Because there's stuff I did not get about AA till I started working with someone else and having a ringside seat for someone's miracle. I've worked with a number of men now who are now working with other men. I think I have some great, great, great grand sponsors at this point. That's watching a fellowship grow up around you. And it's nothing like it. What they say is not an overstatement. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. They say it so nice, they say it twice because they really mean it. And it's so damn true. And I get really passionate about sponsorship, if you couldn't tell. And to think I was ready to blow it off. I know a lot of people will spend their time in AA and never work with another alcoholic. And you're missing out, man. You are just missing out. I don't say that to shame anybody or make them feel bad if they haven't done it. But I tell you, this AA thing just takes on a whole new meaning when you bring it to someone else and you're taking them through the steps. And you're taking yourself through the steps, and I'm revisiting them because I got a built-in forgetter. It's why I keep coming to meetings. It's why I got to keep revisiting these chapters. And someone might leave like they did the other day in Memphis online on a small line from "There's a Solution." I thought, where did they put that in there? Ooh. And the book just comes to life. These guys who have taken the steps through, we still meet with regularly, and we're reading literature together. This morning I was reading "Pass It On" with one of my sponsees, and Dr. Bob and the Old Timers. Some books on the periphery, like "Drop the Rock," "New Pair of Glasses." My bookshelf is filled with and I've never read one of them by myself. It's always with another alcoholic, and these words just come to life when you read them with another alcoholic. Highly recommend it, even after you've worked the steps with them. We're coming to the end here. You guys really, you mean business here. We have a public address system and a microphone and a podium. I didn't know if I was going to be sitting at the end of a banquet table or whatever, but you know what? I would have stood. And you know why? Because Dave Free stood. If you knew Dave Free, he's a gentleman who passed away a few years ago at the age of 95, with about 53 years in these rooms. Proud former Marine, career in the CIA. He worked with a lot of men, helped a lot, saved a lot of lives. He was very passionate about his AA. I watched him tell his story the way I am tonight at Holly Meet, their speaker meeting. That guy dressed in his Sears best, you could tell he just had a love and reverence for the room, like, of course, I'm going to dress up. AA's asked me to speak. Had his Marine cap on. He stood for the whole meeting. 90 years old. I will never not stand for a meeting. If Dave Free's going to do it, I'll do it too. And what Dave Free did at the end of the meeting, so he reached in his lapel like I'm going to do right now. He pulled out this piece of paper and he read it. I'll read it to you now. You'll probably get the metaphor in no time. It's called "The Tale of Two Seas." The Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea are both fed by the same river, the River Jordan. The Sea of Galilee is a prosperous sea full of life, but the Dead Sea sits dormant. Located on the Jordan Rift Valley, it is the lowest place on earth. Why is one sea prosperous and the other stagnant when both are fed by the same stream? The Sea of Galilee flows out to other bodies of water. It receives from the River Jordan and then gives. The Dead Sea takes from the River Jordan but does not flow out anywhere. Water flows in and just sits. Actually, the water gets trapped and evaporates, so it even loses what it has. The Dead Sea is so salty because so much water evaporates due to hot and dry conditions. With it just sitting there, the minerals become more and more concentrated. It is 8.6 times saltier than the ocean, which is why no animals can survive in it. So what is present? Fungi. We have a lot to learn from these two seas. What we give is what we receive. It takes both being open to receive freely so we may be filled and then pouring that out to others. We are not supposed to just keep all we receive to ourselves and sit in it. We are to allow these gifts to flow into us and back out to all those around us to share and give. I made a mad dash for Dave right after the meeting. I said, "Can I have that?" He handed it to me. And if anyone wants this, I'm happy to pass it on to them too. Dave passed away a few years ago, and he had an incredible service down in Palmyra. Place was packed with all the people he knew and his Marine buddies and AA people. I called him a few times toward the end, and word got out he didn't have much time left. And I called him. He was always appreciative of the call. Yeah, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. I envisioned him bedridden with a nurse seeing to his needs and probably not ambulatory. And I went out with my sponsor for a nice walk around Monticello not long after one of my calls. And then he shared with me that, oh, we passed by Moose's on the Creek, which is a very popular spot for military, state troopers, and so forth. It's not there anymore. It was a great greasy spoon by the U-Haul. Rental place right off the 64 exit, just south of town. Moose's by the creek. They've since moved to Boyd's Tavern. Dave was a regular there. And Dave was there just the other morning. Dave was out in public dining. He said, yeah, he was meeting with his sponsor. He's going to die. He's having lunch with his sponsor. Unbelievable. Since that time, I've had a pilgrimage to Israel. When my nephew got ordained into the priesthood, and 30 of us went. Incredible. Highly recommended if that's part of your faith life. And we did Jesus the early years in northern Israel and then down to Jerusalem. And I saw all those places. I saw the Sea of Galilee. It's really more of a lake. It's not that big, but it is fresh and it's beautiful. And we went out in a boat. I saw the River Jordan. It's more of a creek. And we went to where Jesus was baptized. And right across the rivers, the country, nation of Jordan, there's a Jordanian flag. But right about where Jesus is baptized, you take you right there. It's not a very wide body of water at all. But there, got to go in. My nephew baptized us all. It's a wonderful experience. And it led right down to the Dead Sea. And that was the least spiritual place of our journey, but it was a popular space. It felt like an amusement park when we descended upon the Dead Sea. The lowest place on earth is true, why all this is possible there. But what makes it a tourist destination, and it really wasn't much of a spiritual mecca, is the novelty of going in and soaking in the salty water and floating, which is quite a sensation if you're used to being in other bodies. Wow, floating in water, this is weird. And they have industrial strength shower heads and towels because you come out pretty stinking thick with the Dead Sea goop on you. The lowest sea on earth, the lowest point on earth. And as you leave the Dead Sea, the first thing you see, the first commercial establishment waiting you is a grass hut called the lowest bar on earth. And there you can get some frozen daiquiris and margaritas and so forth. Isn't that fitting? The Dead Sea, neighbor to the lowest bar on earth. I don't know about you guys. I'm not spending much time in low bars these days. No, I'm here because I want to be. It's a wonderful thing that the miracle does happen. The obsession gets lifted. But I'm recovered. I'm a recovered alcoholic, but I'm recovering with all my defects. I'm still working on that stuff. Ain't what I want to be, but I'm not what I used to be. So recovering from all that stuff. But another beautiful thing happens. I came here to save my life. No, it's a life-saving measure. It seemed like maybe a bit of a chore and the things you're asking of me. But you hang around long enough, you actually want to be here. And AA becomes a passion. It becomes an interest. It becomes something that you want to do. It all takes care of itself. And those things that I held such a premium on, the old wet faces and wet places, they don't interest me as much. I love this AA life. I wouldn't trade it for anything. They say it's beyond your imagination. Key word is beyond, because what I was imagining was kind of linear. It was this like, oh, I'm not dreaming big enough because I'm dreaming stretch limo and disco ball inside. You're saying mag tires and a hot tub and a supermodel? That no, beyond, over here. A relationship with a power greater than yourself, renewed relationship with family and friends. And there's something that trumps happiness in recovery, and that's the joy of feeling useful. I was of no use to anybody. Get working with someone else and start to feel useful. It's pretty awesome. And being asked to share all that with you last night has been pretty awesome as well. You too, Zoom people. And Billy, thank you so much. God bless y'all. Have a beautiful week. Yeah.